The headline: Saudi Arabia steps up its airstrikes on Yemen, hitting the capital, Sana'a, and a northern grain port, which is a UN-brokered neutral zone. Israel revokes the VIP permit of Palestine's foreign minister following his meeting with the ICC's chief prosecutor over the body's probe into Israeli war crimes. And also, British officials say two officers were seriously injured and some police vehicles were set on fire in Bristol during protests against a bill on police powers. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Saudi-led coalition waging a war on Yemen since 2015 has unleashed dozens of fresh airstrikes against the impoverished nation. The coalition says it has pounded military positions in the capital, Sana'a, and the port of Salif on the Red Sea coast. But the United Nations says some civilian areas also came under attack. According to the UN, a grain port in Salif, as well as a warehouse and a food production company, were targeted. The raids have violated a 2018 agreement brokered by the UN that designates the port of Salif as a neutral zone. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has slammed the attacks, saying these were part of Saudi Arabia's economic warfare against Yemenis. Saudi Arabia has imposed a sea and air blockade on Yemen, which has badly hampered humanitarian efforts to save civilian lives in Yemen. Elsewhere, Israel has revoked the VIP permit of the Palestinian foreign minister after his return from a trip to the Hague-based International Criminal Court, which is probing war crimes against the regime. The revocation of the VIP status means Riyad al-Maliki will need Israel's permission for any future travel abroad. Last week, Maliki met with the ICC's chief prosecutor to demand she speeds up an investigation into Israel's war crimes in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. He also called on the court to end the era of impunity and start the path of accountability for Israel. The investigation is expected to look into the 2014 Israel war on Gaza, killing of Palestinians along Israeli barriers separating Gaza with occupied territories, as well as the regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. Israel has fiercely opposed the probe. Our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Candil, has given us the latest on Israel's revocation of the Palestinian foreign minister's VIP status.
There is no official statement from the Israeli regime on the issue. However, Israeli media were quoting some Israeli officials saying that Riyad al-Maliki wanted, with the with the Palestinian Authority, to work with the ICC in order to harm Israeli senior officials and to prevent their freedom of movement. This is why the Israelis revoked the VIP card. Let's remind our viewers that there's no airports, or the only means for the Palestinians to leave the occupied West Bank is through an Israeli border controlled by the Israeli officials between Jordan and the occupied territories. Now, the Palestinian Authority said that it collected numerous files that would help the ICC investigators in order to prosecute Israeli officials, because Israel is not a member, so they cannot, the ICC can't prosecute Israel as a state or a regime. However, they can prosecute and bring to trials Israeli senior officials, Israeli soldiers, and even Israeli ministers, with making proofs and bringing proofs that those Israeli officials committed crimes against Palestinians.
We're going to go back to our top story, where the Saudis have unleashed dozens of fresh airstrikes against Yemen. Hossein al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, is joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Mr. al-Bukhaiti, tell us more about these recent attacks. A UN-designated neutral zone was also targeted by the Saudis.
Yes, the attack took place on Hodeidah, on the Salif port. That we know all that Hodeidah has an agreement which was signed in Stockholm in December 2018. But the Saudi has strike a food warehouse and a food factory with double-type airstrike, killing one civilian and injuring other six civilians. But actually what is silly from the UN observer who are in Hodeidah at this time, they said there was two strike, and then they have not actually mentioned or say Saudi or coalition strike. They left it as if something is unknown. Nobody knows where this strike come from, and to show you that the United Nations actually try so hard not to mention Saudi in any of their statement. And yesterday there was about five airstrikes on the capital Sana'a. They have targeted the so-called military maintenance. This area, central Sana'a, has been targeted, I think, from the beginning of the war with maybe 80 to 70 airstrikes. And there is nothing in that area, only old truck, old military vehicles, some banned tires at that area. That's why there was a huge fire at that place where the strikes took place. And to be honest with you, that all those strikes actually shows that the Saudi actually has not got anything to bring to the battle, only to target every now and then the capital Sana'a, and to keep target and many civilians area. Meanwhile, Yemeni army and popular committee are fighting in the front line facing Saudi and Saudi backed forces, and they are getting closer to liberate Marib. And I just want to as well mention that the UN humanitarian coordinator, David Grizzly, have said an hour ago that he has arrived in Safar Airport in Marib. That airport actually is a small airport that was built for Safar oil company, for a foreign company to reach Marib easier. But he has used this airport, as he said, for the first time, and he announced what he called the launch of a humanitarian flight to Safar, as he said, to enhance access and assist for humanitarian aid for millions of Yemeni. And I believe that this step from the United Nations, who are actually ignoring to open Hodeidah port, who are not asking Saudi to lift the blockade from Hodeidah port, with 70%, as the United Nations have said many times, 70% of humanitarian aid comes through that port. So now they went to an area which is close to the battlefield, which is in Marib, to use it, as they say, a humanitarian point to help millions of Yemeni. But I believe that they are doing so not to allow Yemeni army to enter the city, because if they will enter and liberate the city, then we're going to say that the United Nations will cry out loud and will say that Safar is one of the areas that are used by the United Nations to bring humanitarian aid, and they will actually use this kind of lies in the media to deceive the international community that the Houthi is targeting UN zones who are millions of Yemeni depend on them, where meanwhile there are 17 million Yemeni civilians who are suffering, who are starving to death. According to the United Nations 2 weeks ago, 400 million Yemeni children under the age of 5 are facing death this year if the United Nations or if the international community will not do anything or interfere to stop that. And what the United Nations has actually did to interfere, they went to an area which is a battle zone to launch what they say a new flight to that area for humanitarian access, and they show you that the United Nations and all its humanitarian agency are actually working in the favor of Saudi Arabia and of Saudi-backed forces in Yemen.
All right, thanks a lot, activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. March 19th marks the anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. 18 years of war have cost Iraq dearly, causing the destruction of infrastructure there. Thousands have lost their lives, while millions more have been displaced as well.
September 11, 2001. Two hijacked airplanes were flown directly to the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City. A few days later, U.S. Congress passed a resolution which has been used to justify Washington's military interventions abroad and detentions in Guantanamo Bay prison since. The authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, granted the U.S. President the authority to use force against those who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. According to the Cost of War Project reports, since 2003, over 9.2 million Iraqis have been displaced across the country or have become refugees abroad. Washington is also responsible for around 300,000 deaths in Iraq between 2003 and 2009, a figure that could be much higher. Over two-thirds were civilians. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. That's while during the 2016 presidential campaigns, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. But Washington's acts did not end there. In 2020, four members of the U.S. private military firm Blackwater were pardoned. That is while Blackwater's mercenaries were prosecuted and found guilty of multiple criminal acts committed during a 2007 massacre at Nisr Square in Baghdad, which left 17 unarmed civilians dead and at least 20 wounded. The U.S.-led war in Iraq has had its negative impact on American people's lives as well. U.S. taxpayers have paid nearly $2 trillion in war-related costs on the Iraq War alone. That's an average of $8,000 per person and represents 9% of the national debt.
What the U.S. intended to do in Iraq is exactly what we see right now. The outcome that they were looking for is the destruction of the country, its continuous chaos in this country, in order for them to loot all the resources at the lowest cost.
The so-called anti-terror campaign the U.S. launched after the 9/11 attacks has resulted in invading half a dozen countries. The campaign has also led to setting up hundreds of offshore bases and the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives. With America's forever wars lasting for nearly two decades and costing more than $6 trillion, calls are growing on Washington to reassess its policies. That comes as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs.
A recent report published by the Cost of War Project says the U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That is while China is the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
The war on terrorism is a war for terrorism, when in reality, the terrorism being created by the United States, the intended target is the destruction of the Arab and Muslim people.
After spending over $6.4 trillion and ruining lives of millions during the War on Terror campaign, Washington has failed to win a single war as of yet. With that, why does Washington fail to learn its lesson? The U.S. should correct the course now by repealing the 2002 AUMF.
Two British officers have been injured after protests against a controversial parliamentary bill turned violent in the city of Bristol. The demonstrators also vandalized a police station and set some vehicles ablaze after thousands hit the streets defying COVID-19 restrictions. The bill in question, which is currently going through Parliament, would give the police in England and Wales more power to impose conditions on non-violent protests. Those convicted under the proposed legislation could also face fines or jail terms, anger is already boiling in the country over police violence during a recent vigil held for a woman kidnapped and murdered by an officer. Police have faced widespread outrage over their handling of the March 13th rallies for victim Sarah Everard. A Canadian man has gone on trial in China on espionage charges amid strained relations between Ottawa and Beijing. Michael Kovrig, a former diplomat, has been in custody since December 2019. His hearing in Beijing comes days after a closed-door trial of another Canadian, Michael Spavor. Both were formally charged last June with spying. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau blasted China for holding the trial, quote, in secret. The trials appear to be in retaliation for Canada's arrest of the chief financial officer of Chinese tech company Huawei in 2019 on a U.S. warrant, but China insists that the tensions are not linked to the case of Meng Wanzhou, who was under house arrest in Vancouver. Thousands of Americans have marched in major cities, including Atlanta, New York, and Washington, D.C., to protest violence and racism against Asian Americans. Protests also took place in Montreal, Canada. The demonstrations come a few days after a white man in the metropolitan area of Atlanta killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women. Several American officials have also joined the rallies. U.S. Senate Majority Leader slammed hate crimes at the New York rally held in support of the country's Asian American community.
And I am urging, along with my colleagues, that our Justice Department prosecute fully and completely anybody who commits a hate crime against Asians or anybody else.
Schumer also noted that hate against one is hate against all, and such actions will not be tolerated. Meanwhile, U.S. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth has expressed doubts about the FBI director's initial assessment that the fatal shooting may not constitute a hate crime. Duckworth demanded a deeper investigation into the incident, saying the killings were racially motivated. Earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden also denounced the rise in hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans in the country. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. The second day, Aunt Mahin, then Aunt Atefe,
Oh, no. I'll visit her on the third day. Her house is really far from here, and I'd lose a lot of time in the traffic. You may ask what I'm doing. Well, I'm writing down the names of my relatives who I'm going to visit during Nowruz holiday. Why? Because it's an ancient tradition. Visiting family, relatives, or friends, literally, eydidani, is one of the customs of Nowruz. According to this tradition, firstly, the older relatives are visited. Relatives, friends, neighbors, colleagues, or even acquaintances also visit each other during Nowruz. These visits have no special time and starts from 1st to 13th of Farvardin. These visits may even last until the end of Farvardin. The host or hosts usually return the visit the next day, meaning that they usually go to their guest's home as a revisit the next day. There are also other customs regarding the ancient tradition. In some of Iran's cities, it is a tradition that guests sit around the half-seen cloth and eat the traditional foods of this holiday. These foods include sweets and pastries that are baked in small sizes, nuts, fruits, or even tea and coffee. During Nowruz, the elderly give money to youngsters and children as a gift, which is called AD. Well, this is my first visit today. My grandma was really happy to see me. I got it from the shine in her eyes. She also gave me AD. My grandma always gives us new banknotes, which have been put between the pages of the Noble Quran. And as soon as the new year begins, she opens the Noble Quran and gives the money as a gift to the family members. Oh, I love these nice traditions of Nowruz. Oh, God, how happy I got by seeing Aunt Mahin. It was for a long time that I hadn't seen her and my cousins. You know, visiting relatives during Nowruz is a very good tradition because it strengthens the family bonds. I should keep in my mind that in the new year, I visit Aunt Mahin more than before. And I am now by a hospital. You know why? I'm going to visit those patients in this hospital who are alone during Nowruz. I've also bought a big bucket of flour for them. A flower for each, as AD. These flowers are so fragrant. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
got debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the leader of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that the United States can't be trusted, as had been proven time and time again. Despite this, if all U.S. sanctions are lifted and it's proven that they really are lifted, then Iran will return to all of its commitments of the JCPOA. He added that Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign has failed and has actually made Iran to be more creative and self-reliant.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says if the U.S. practically lifts all sanctions, Iran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran began scaling down its JCPOA commitments in May 2019, a year after former U.S. President Donald Trump walked away from the accord. Iran says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the pact and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. Iran and the administration of Joe Biden now remain in a standoff over who must take the first step and come back to full compliance with the deal. The multinational accord was signed under former U.S. President Barack Obama. Ayatollah Khamenei says the main problem over the issue is that U.S. promises have no credibility and Iran cannot trust Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon the maximum pressure campaign launched by Donald Trump, saying it failed and disgraced the U.S. He warned that Joe Biden's administration will fail as well if it continues that campaign. Ayatollah Khamenei called U.S. sanctions against countries a big crime, as they hinder access to food and medicine. He said in Iran, young people have turned U.S. sanctions into opportunities by producing goods that had to be imported. Some politicians inside the U.S. also agree that the so-called maximum pressure campaign has failed to produce any results. They include incumbent Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Iran has time and again said the ball is now in the U.S. court. Tehran says it's Washington that should decide on whether to go ahead with that failed campaign or change course.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate. Dr. Fuad Izzadi, Professor of World Studies, University of Tehran, out of Tehran, and Mustafa Khoshchash, political commentator, also out of Tehran. I'd like to take this time to wish both of them a very happy Nowruz. Thanks so much for being with us. Starting it off with Dr. Izzadi. Now, the leader's speech was filled with optimism and resistance. This is despite more than four decades of U.S. sanctions. I want to start from here. And what do you attribute that to overall?
Well, you know, the Trump policy of maximum pressure campaign continues right at the campaign. And we have not changed any of the policies of Trump. We have not said this change.
Dr. Izzadi, I'm going to interrupt you because we're having some audio problems. I'm going to turn to Mustafa Khoshchash and ask him that question, and hopefully the audio will get corrected and I can come back to you. Mustafa, your take on the question I just asked.
Yeah, greetings. Thanks for having me. Happy New Year, Marzia.
Thank you.
I wish you a good year. I wish a good year for the friends, the audience, and people throughout the world. Well, you know, these annual addresses that are made by the Iranian leader on the first or second day of the Persian New Year are of strategic importance because in these speeches, the Iranian leader portrays the strategy of the country in each year. And in those years that we have elections, especially the presidential election, they are much more important. But this year, because we are going to have not only city council elections and parliament midterms, midterm elections, but also we are going to have presidential elections in a couple of months after 8 years of President Rouhani in office. Now, the country is preparing to have a transition to a new era. You know, the Iranian leader is duty-bound by the Constitution to decide and to specify the macro-scale policies or strategies of the country based on 5 articles of the Constitution, and in various areas of foreign policy, economy, and domestic politics, culture, society, and so on and so. And this year, in his speech, we could see very vividly a new strategy, a new roadmap for the country. In 3 parts, he dealt with Iranian economy, including the sanctions, also the election. And the third, he, I believe, talked about the conclusion. The macro-scale policy is working on a confrontation and resistance against the United States, meaning that under President Rouhani, we all know that he was given an agenda by the public, by the Iranians who elected him to office, to go for a conflict resolution with the United States and the West and the Europeans to see if there is a chance. But it was proved time and again and again, for the 5th, 6th times throughout the past 2 decades, that the U.S. is unwilling to resolve its conflicts with Iran. So they have left Iran with one only choice, to reinvigorate itself. So resisting against the U.S. and its sanctions, it needs instruments. What are those instruments? First, reinvigorating your economy, that I will elaborate on that later, in domestic and international aspects, and also having an administration that's fit and qualified to go after this new strategy and approach. So the speech today, it was not new. The Iranian leader has been speaking of reinvigorating domestic economy or economy of resistance, as well as working on foreign policy in other aspects than just the United States or the West. But this time, he said it very vividly, and he meant really to show us a new strategy will be adopted by the country.
Stay with me, Mostafa. Stay with me, Mostafa. Let me get Fuad back in this conversation, and I'll get back to you. Fuad, hopefully the audio has been fixed. Now, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S.'s maximum pressure campaign has failed, and they know it. However, despite that, Washington still doesn't change its tactics. What's your take on that, as far as the reason that it really seems that the U.S. does not change its approach?
You know, there are very few things that Iranian leaders and American leaders agree upon, and the maximum pressure campaign failing is actually one of them. We had Rob Malley, who is person in charge of Iran portfolio in the State Department. He's in charge of the Iran Action Group. Had an interview just a couple of days ago saying that the maximum pressure campaign has failed. We even had the person who was in charge of the Iran Action Group during the Trump administration, the notorious Elliot Abrams, a couple of days ago, said that Iran has been able to stabilize its economy, basically saying that the economic pressures and economic warfare that the United States sponsored has failed. So everybody seems to agree that the previous policy has failed. The only problem we have is that this addiction that Washington has towards sanctions, and they don't want to change that addiction. They don't want to get rid of it. They don't want to change the failed policies of the last 40 years. So they continue to do the same thing. And until they change that, they're not going to get anywhere. And what the leader said today, I think, emphasizes that point, that the United States was the party that left the agreement. They can come back to the agreement if they want to. But Iran is not going to act the way Iran acted in 2015. Iran is going to wait for the U.S. to implement its obligations to lift sanctions. And Iran is going to make sure that these sanctions are actually lifted in practice, not just on the paper. And if the U.S. does that, then Ayatollah Khamenei said that Iran would go back to its obligations. And this is the maybe the fourth or fifth time he's repeating mm-hmm. the same policy. And I think the end result is that the U.S. Has a choice whether to follow the failed policies of the past or make a correction and realize that they are not achieving their foreign policy goals.
Okay, what about that, Mustafa? As Fuad said, making correction of the past, are they going to continue going after their same policies? I mean, if time and time again the results are the same, during the 40 years, 43 years to be exact, the U.S. has continually put pressure on Iran. However, obviously, the Islamic Republic is still standing. So what is it about the United States that prevents it from making that change, making that move, in order to try to get a different result when they have seen, as the leader has said today, that as a matter of fact, the maximum pressure campaign has not only failed, but in many ways has helped Iran become more self-reliant?
Well, by 2005, at least that's what we know for sure, the United States came up with the conclusion that regime change is not possible, military action is not possible, but it may not also live with an independent state like Iran that represents a role model for the Muslim world, for the regional nations, especially those in the heartland of the world, in the Middle East or West Asia. Therefore, they came up with this strategy of containment that was put into practice a few months before actually Obama came to office, but mainly it was practiced by Obama, and they worked on that, and they developed this strategy under Obama that relies very much on sanctions as a tool, as well as posing credible military threat in order to push Tehran to the talks, not for conflict resolution, but for containing Iran's power in various areas of the nuclear industry, missile industries, regional power. And God knows they would continue with Iran's nanotechnology, laser technology, and so on and so forth. They mean to keep weakening Iran through this formula, and then once Iran is weakened enough, then they would go for the regime change, and that would not stop then. They would go for, you know, decomposing the country. That's part of the greater Middle East plan that they have for the entire Middle East, decomposing all and forcing all countries into collapse in order to secure their the exercise of their hegemony as well as the security of Israel. So they are not looking for a conflict resolution. That's why Biden would do anything you want, but he may not remove the sanctions effectively. He might remove secondary at maximum. I don't believe that it's going to happen in the next few months, at least before the next Iranian administration comes to office.
Okay.
But at maximum, if he removes anything, he would remove the secondary nuclear-related sanctions. But because of the FSW fortifying sanctions wall rule, nothing would happen. The Iranian Central Bank would not be able to do any kind of transaction. Why? Because they want to keep the pressures in Tehran.
Okay, so stay with me, Mustafa, stay with me. Let me get to back to Fuad. And Fuad, when we look at the overall situation now, today during this speech, Ayatollah Khamenei reiterated how the U.S. has no credibility and that their agreements are worthless. I want to look at that on a broader basis beyond Iran. So do you think that with the JCPOA and the way Washington handled its side, that the U.S. has been damaged internationally and has proven itself to be unreliable to other countries, and how that would affect countries in dealing with the U.S. now?
You know, if you go back to the same people who are in the White House and in the State Department, and in the CIA, the people who have taken new jobs in the Biden administration, if you go back to the statements that they made when Trump left the nuclear agreement, this was exactly what they said, that by Trump leaving the agreement, the United States has lost any form of credibility that it had, and other countries would be foolish to enter any type of agreement with the United States, given the fact that U.S. Political stability is in serious question. You could have Trump coming back to the White House, or people like Mike Pompeo running for election and maybe winning in 4 years, and then the whole thing would change again. And this is another reason that Ayatollah Khamenei said that getting things written on a piece of paper is not going to work out this time. Last time, Iran accepted that type of procedure. They accepted the U.S. Writing its commitments, and then in practice, they found out that the same administration, the Obama administration, was not really interested in implementing what they agreed. So that experience has taught Iran and has taught many other countries that the only way to deal with the United States is to deal with the United States in practice, in action, not on paper, not on promises, because the American government, whether it's the Trump administration or the Biden administration, whether the Republicans or Democrats, do not follow the promises that they make. And every time a new government comes into office, as if the country just started, a new government. And you saw this with the Biden administration. The fact that the Biden administration is asking Iran to go back to the agreement first is basically forgetting the fact that it was Trump that left the agreement. So this is exactly what Trump did. Didn't pay attention to what the Obama administration did. And since we have seen this repeated in the last number of years, I think Iranian leaders are going to be much more cautious with regard to the United States, and they want to get things done in practice instead mm-hmm. of promises.
Okay, well, Mustafa, there are signs of failed U.S. policies. Some are saying that Iran is stronger than it was when sanctions originally started, and that the United States is weaker. So it shows that throughout the years, throughout the decades, this pressure has not brought Iran to its knees. But we see a very, very different United States than at the beginning of when the sanctions first started. Your take on that?
Well, it's highly important to note that the United States containment strategy works through, as I said, two main pillars of sanctions and posing credible military threat, but they also use other areas, including any kind of area that could increase the costs of independence and progress for Iran in hard, semi-hard, and soft warfare areas. But let's remember that in these two dimensions, with regard to these two pillars of sanctions and posing credible military threat, after triple incidents in the Persian Gulf last year, we remember what happened to the U.S. Global Hawk or Triton that was shot down by Iran, and the Iranian missile strike, also an Ain al-Assad, which was not responded by the United States, despite the very fact that Trump had warned to bomb 52 cultural centers in Iran. So posing a credible military threat is no more credible. It has been discredited. Iran is not afraid, and as you are hearing, the Pentagon officials are saying that they are here for deterrence against Iran, irrespective of their smear campaign against Iran and Iran's military power. It's highly important to note that Iran has become such a power that they now are speaking of deterrence. So Iran has mainly discredited U.S. military threat as part of the containment strategy. With regard to the sanctions, they have imposed sanctions on all Iranian economies several times, on all Iranian actors, sectors, banking, petrochemical industry, as well as Iranian crude industry. So they are empty with any more, or they're empty-minded and empty-handed with regard to finding new areas to sanction, to increase the pressure against the Iranian economy. And as Richard Nefkin and Barack Obama have stated,
20 seconds,
there
Mustafa.
There is a limited 2-year-long period for effectiveness of the sanctions. And in May, it finished. Now, the efficiency of the sanctions is going down. All means that the U.S. is at the end of the road with regard to increasing pressures on Iran. But now, Iran is just at the beginning of the road in order to speed up its measures to lay more and more leverage on the United States. And okay. I believe we are going to witness such a strategy in this year and the years after that.
All right, so, and on that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us, Dr. Fuad Izzadi, Professor of World Studies at the University of Tehran in Tehran, and Mostafa Khoshchash, a political commentator, also joining us from Tehran. And as always, appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you right here next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Allah, Allah,
Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند این ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allah ya Allah wallahu akbar. Leadership from the perspective of Imam Khomeini. The government can unilaterally revoke a Sharia contract that it has itself signed with people when it is understood to be against the interest of the country or Islam. It is also able to stop any practice, be the worship or not, if it is recognized to be against the good of Islam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio, and I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi. We were discussing about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in this program, and we were talking about his viewpoints in regards to the religion of Islam. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini in regards to the religion of Islam. And this part of speech of Imam Khomeini has basically made many things clear. And in this part, Imam Khomeini has said the things that Islam has prohibited are those that draw our youth to corruption. So basically, he is talking about the philosophy of something being prohibited, something being haram. So basically, he is saying that if you see there is something which is haram for the youth, for the individuals, or in the society, practicing something is haram, it is forbidden, it is because that it draw our youth to corruption. Now, if we can take examples, if we start taking names of different things, for example, drinking, alcohol is haram, it's forbidden, it's prohibited. Why? Because it is taking our youth to corruption. We have seen many people after they become drunk, what they do. The alcohol itself, it's najis. It's impure. It is najis. We know that the alcoholic drink itself, it is impure. So it leads our youth to corruption. People don't have sense when they drink. They don't know what they are doing. يا حي يا قيوم يا حي يا قيوم يا حي يا قيوم يا حي يا قيوم So basically, because it has a lot of corruption in it. That's why it's been forbidden by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, if we say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has forbidden lying, it's because in the lie there is a corruption. If lying was permissible in Islam, it wasn't forbidden in Islam, then there was no way that we could trust anyone. And we know that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he was in Mecca in the early age, he was known as Sadiq and Amin, the truthful and the trustworthy person. Now, being truthful and trustworthy is when you are true, when you do not lie to people, when people can trust you, when they know that whatever you say is right and you never lie to people. And that's why Islam has forbidden this. Why? Because this attitude, these characteristics of being truthful and trustworthy, these are the golden characteristics that someone can have. These are the good things that someone can have. And there are many more, especially, you know, if we talk about the backbiting, it is forbidden in Islam. Why? Because a person feels humiliated when someone backbites him or her. So therefore, it's been forbidden in Islam. It's been prohibited in Islam. Why? It's all because, as Imam Khomeini has said, it is all because these things, these forbidden things, these haram things, they draw our youth to corruption. And the aim of the leader of the society and the aim of the society is to take out the youth from corruption and to take them towards the incorruptible society, inshallah. May Allah give us tawfiq to learn and to live according to the teachings of the Quran and Ahlul Bayt, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we wanted to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed, I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community, or per se, like the Iranian community, or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition, and that I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is, like, majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival, and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavy damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies that caused the death of tens of thousands of people. Many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say the army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees. A scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed, and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants